Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, September the 5th, 1995. In the Creekside Room this morning, our speaker is Cedric Rotten. His subject, Palestine, Kingdoms Through Ptolemies. Let's listen in.
My name is Cedric Rotten. The title of this session is The History of the Land of Palestine, Kingdoms Through Ptolemies, or I might even go to the Maccabees, depending on how long it takes. Most of you were here yesterday, right? So I don't need to rehash, and since Bill already knows everything, I don't need to rehash all the material from yesterday. But I would like to emphasize again one of the things that we talked about yesterday. And that is that as we think about the relevance of the history of the land of Palestine to anything that's happening over there today, again to remember that as the people we came to call Israel moved into the land of Palestine, there are already folks there. And as we continue to look at the history of the land of Palestine through what we're going to look at today in terms of about eight centuries or so. Notice that there are always folks there besides those who came to be called Jews. And so that's something that I think is of relevance to look at. We kind of ended last time with looking at Solomon, but we didn't give Solomon very much airplay, and I want to do that. I want to do that as we begin this time and talk about the reign of Solomon, because it sets up what follows after Solomon. What do you remember about Solomon? What's that?
Wise.
Okay, everybody believes he's wise, right? That was.
And many wives.
He married a lot of. Had a lot of wives. Why did he have so many wives?
Political
alliances. Uh huh. Okay, so he cemented political alliances with a lot of other kingdoms around him through his marriages. Was his having a lot of wives looked upon with favor by the prophets and the writers of the biblical record? No, not too much.
Not unless they were Jewish.
Now, what else did Solomon do?
He built
the temple. What else besides building the temple did he do?
His own palace,
okay. Besides his palace, what did he build? Okay, he built a lot of forts and cities. Megiddo, if you go to Israel. Megiddo, remember we mentioned yesterday, Armageddon place. Megiddo was one of the areas that Solomon built up. Although when you go there and tour that site, what they claim there now is that a lot of the building up of Megiddo was done by Ahab later on. That Solomon started it, but Solomon didn't build it to the extent that Ahab built it later on. But that's one of the cities that he built. This map kind of is, it's entitled Solomon Wheeler Dealer. It says, Solomon's agents control the sale of the horses from the Hittites up north. There's iron exported from, iron from Syria exported to Egypt through the land of Palestine. There is a bronze foundry. Solomon was the middleman for chariots going from Egypt to the Hittites. Solomon's fleet of trade ships were manned by Hiram. You know who Hiram was? Hiram of Tyre, present-day Lebanon, Phoenicia at that time. So there's copper and iron smelting. That should be relevant for those of us at Holden here. So trade went through. Trade went through from Egypt up north, up into Syria and north, went through the land of Palestine, land of Israel, and along the way there was a tax. you've been through toll roads and paid to go on the road. Well, they had to pay to go through the land too when Solomon controlled it. And so that was one of the ways he got revenue. But Solomon had a massive building program. I mean, he built and he built and he built, and anybody who's built anything knows that it takes a lot of money to build it, right? It takes an enormous amount of money. And what else does it take?
Labor.
Now, who's going to build all these things that Solomon wanted to build?
Slaves.
But you know what? So one of the things that Solomon set up his followers for disaster is he not only employed slaves. Of course, there were those who had been Canaanites, those who had been around the land of Palestine, living there besides the Jews. But Solomon also decided to draft some of his own people. And because he drafted some of his own people and involved in the work, they... you remember the 60s and how people didn't like the draft then? They didn't like the draft back in Solomon's time either. And so he set himself up for that. Look at 1 Kings, if any of you have your Bible, look at 1 Kings chapter 11. Chapter 11, verses 4 to 6. Chapter 11, verses 4 to 6. Would somebody read that? Any volunteers?
For when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not wholly true to the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. So Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and did not wholly follow the Lord as David his father had done.
Okay. Then jump down to verse 9.
And the Lord was angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice.
Let's read through 13.
And had commanded him concerning this thing, that he should not go after other gods. But he did not keep what the Lord commanded. Therefore the Lord said to Solomon, since this has been your mind, and you have not kept my covenant and my statutes which I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom from you and will give it to your servant. Yet for the sake of David your father, I will not do it in your days, but I will tear it out of the hand of your son. However, I will not tear away all the kingdom, but I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of David my servant and for the sake of Jerusalem which I have chosen.
Okay, so what's the prophecy about? Prophecy says that there's going to be a divided kingdom, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to be divided up. Now, during Solomon's time, all was not smooth, despite it what is generally thought of as a peaceful reign. There were occasional people who cropped up who had some objections to what Solomon was doing. One of those guys was named Jeroboam. You ever heard that name? Now, Jeroboam was apparently he is one of these bosses, you know, middle-level management guys up north. And Solomon got wind of him causing some problems, fomenting some revolutionary ideas. And so Jeroboam escaped town, and he went down to Egypt. And he was in Egypt until Solomon died. When Solomon died, He got a call to come back to the land, and Solomon's son was named Rehoboam. Let's look at 1 Kings chapter 11. There is a prophecy, 1 Kings chapter 11, there is a prophecy, verse 31. The prophet says to Jeroboam, "Take for yourselves 10 pieces, for thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, see, I am about to tear the kingdom from the hand of Solomon and will give you 10 tribes. One tribe will remain his for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, the city I have chosen out of all the tribes." So Jeroboam came back, and he started a rival sanctuary. If you look at 1 Kings 12, Rehoboam is the son of Solomon. And Rehoboam, instead of reading it all, I'll just summarize some of it here. Rehoboam had the 10 tribes from the north come to him and say, look, give us some relief. Relief from taxes, relief from all this forced labor and building, relief from being in your army and all that sort of thing. You are oppressing us too much. Rehoboam said, well, I'll think about it. Now, let me think it over for a few days. Rehoboam was not very wise. After a few days, he came back and he said, instead of giving you relief, I'm going to make it harder on you than my father Solomon made it on you. I'm going to be even tougher than he was. And what happened as a result of that is the divided kingdom. The 10 tribes... What were called the 10 tribes are in the north. That's in the orange color. And then Judah is in the south, which is what Rehoboam controlled. Can you make that out a little bit? Notice that what is on Israel's side is over, see, here's the Jordan River, is also over on the other side of the Jordan River, the Trans-Jordan side of the river. Down here is Moab. This is Sycophagus is Beth Shean. Beth Shean is where... it's one of the cities of the Decapolis. Have you heard of the Decapolis, the 10 Greek cities? This is on the west side of the Jordan River. And this is the city where Saul and his son were hung on the walls of that city when they were killed in battle. Here, down here at Shechem, there's Samaria. So Jeroboam... became the king of that area known as the Northern Kingdom or Israel, and Judah is in the south. Now, Jeroboam wasn't very bright either, according to the biblical record. Jeroboam, instead of following the God Yahweh exclusively, Jeroboam allowed worship of other gods. But more than that, one of the things that Jeroboam wanted to do politically is he said, look, if everybody still goes down from here, down to Jerusalem to worship at the temple, then I'm really never going to be truly their total king. And this, you know, they're truly not going to be separate from those in the south if they have to go down and worship and consider the central place of worship to be down here. So he said, instead of you going down, said the people, instead of going down to Jerusalem and worshiping, he said, we'll make a new altar up here in Shechem, and you can worship up there. So you don't have to go down to Jerusalem and worship. And of course, that further created the division between the two kingdoms, between the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom of Judah. Now, there are several hundred years worth of lots of kings. Any of you ever seen the lists of the kings of Israel and the lists of the kings of Judah? And if we went through all of them, that would take us forever and a day, so we're not going to do that. But I'd like to point out several of the kings. Do you know the name Ahab? What do you remember about Ahab? Jezebel. Ahab and Jezebel. No, who was Jezebel? His wife, okay, but where did Jezebel come from? Remember where Jezebel came from? Jezebel was the daughter of one of the Phoenician kings. And she was apparently a very strong-willed woman. And Ahab was married to her. Ahab's father, Omri, arranged that marriage. And she came down, and brought with her the worship of Baal. Okay. And who was the one who didn't take too kindly to the worship of Baal in the northern kingdom? Elijah. Okay, you've all heard of Elijah, and what happened? What was the famous story? Pick your brains here. There was a contest. Where was the contest?
Mount Carmel.
One of the things that interested me when I went to Israel was I thought of Mount Carmel before I went as a mountain like Mount Rainier. You know, I thought, well, you know, it's a mount. There's a mountain there. You know, you go up the mountain. But Mount Carmel is not a mountain like Mount Rainier. It's kind of a range is what it is. And it ends up at what is today Haifa. The modern Jewish city of Haifa is at the end of Mount Carmel. So someplace up there, I wasn't fortunate enough to go traipsing around on top of Mount Carmel except for Haifa. So have you done that, Bill? Did you go to one of the spots where they consider that contest to have been?
I don't remember that they pointed out the specific spot.
Yeah.
It's a large pinpoint.
As we drove along the road, they said, well, this brook here is the place where Elijah went and killed all the prophets of Baal and dumped their bodies and that sort of thing. So there was this contest between, and who won out, of course?
Elijah.
Elijah, the God Yahweh, won out. But, of course, that didn't settle the issue, did it? There was still the worship of Baal, and Jezebel still held sway in the land. And eventually, there is that great story of what happens to Jezebel. Yeah, she gets tossed down on the ground, and the dogs eat her. Beautiful, some real interesting stories in the Bible, aren't there? Well, one of the things that Ahab did is built the city of Samaria and make that the capital of that region. Later on, there was another Jeroboam, who we call Jeroboam II, and he lived during the time of the prophets Amos and Hosea, or Amos and Hosea lived in the time of the prophets of Jeroboam. And can you find Amos in your Bible? Look all the way to the minor prophets, way back after Daniel. Amos. Amos chapter 5. In Amos chapter 5, the prophet is condemning Israel. You look down at verse 11. And what does he say? Verse 11 to 15. Somebody want to read that? Amos 5, 11 to 15.
Therefore, because you trample upon the poor and take from him exactions of wheat, you have built houses of hewn stone, but you shall not dwell in them. You have planted pleasant vineyards, but you shall not drink their wine. For I know how many are your transgressions, and how great are your sins. You who afflict the righteous, who take a bribe, and turn aside the needy in the gate. Therefore he who is prudent will keep silent in such a time, for it is an evil time.
Let's see, down to 15.
Seek good and not evil, that you may live. And so the Lord, the God of hosts, will be with you, as you have said. Hate evil and love good and establish justice in the gate. It may be that the Lord, the God of hosts, will be gracious to the remnant of Joseph.
Okay. Why do you think this is important?
Mentioning of Joseph?
Okay, well, the remnant of Joseph there. I was thinking of its importance in another way. One of the things that the biblical writers often condemn Israel for is going after other gods besides Yahweh. And they say the reason that Israel is having a great deal of trouble is they go after other gods besides Yahweh, right? But that's not the only reason that they condemn Israel. If we look at this passage in Amos, we note that that this has nothing to say about Yahweh at all. It says, how you been treating the folks? You know, Bill talked this morning in the Bible study about the kingdom of God and how Jesus looked at things. And this is the same upside-down way of looking at things. It's not the folks who have built the great houses of stone that God looks with favor upon. In fact, because you've done that and have taken bribes and have pushed down the needy and have not done justice in the gate, the gate in the cities of the ancient world was the place where justice was dispensed. It was the courthouse, the place where they discussed together what should be done and what shouldn't be done. Well, you haven't done justice. Because of that, evil is going to befall you. So it's not just not following Yahweh that the prophets condemned Israel for. It is also for this sort of thing that Jesus, again, would bring up later on in his ministry. So I think that's important to note. Let's see. 21 to 24 is also that famous verse. Verse 24, let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. And you've probably heard sermons on that sometime or another. Along about 745, the kingdom split took place in 922. That's when about the time Solomon died, and the kingdom split took place in 922. Along about 745, there arose a force that had been dormant for some time before that, called Assyria. You see the Assyrians there? There's the capital of Nineveh. That's in present day what country, do you think? Right there. So there's Iraq. I'm not sure which part of the border Nineveh was on, but you get the general idea. That was Assyria arose, a guy by the name of Tiglath-Pileser, something like that, in 745. He began an expansionist policy. He wanted to increase the territory that the Assyrians controlled. And with increasing the territory, he also wanted to be able that way to get tribute. What's tribute? It's kind of a tax upon somebody else, right? You pay this money to me, and in the streets of the cities, you know, where the gangs operate, they'll go to a shop owner and say, let's pay me a little protection money. Well, that's what that's an ancient practice. The Assyrians did that, and they wanted to expand. In 722, he started that in 745. 722, there was another king of Assyria who was named Shalmaneser, and then after him, Sargon. And they came in and they did what the prophets had been predicting was going to happen to Israel for years. And what was the thing that they predicted was going to happen to Israel? Israel was, Israel is going to be overcome and captured and defeated because of their sin. Their sin not only of not following Yahweh, but their sin of how they were treating people as well, according to Amos. And so Assyria came along, and Assyria marched down through Assyria, and there's Lebanon there, Phoenicia, and Israel. Now, there is another great power in the world at that time, Egypt. And if you read the history, there's a continual contest between who has the most power. You know, is it Egypt that's going to go up here and control this area, or Assyria and then eventually Babylon is going to come down here and control it? And so there's always this contest. Look who's caught in the middle. Okay? Who's always caught in the middle? Because, see, this is all, you don't go through this area because this is all desert. You're going to go the path of least resistance geographically, so you're going to go down through there. And this is where there's something worth taking. There isn't anything worth taking over here. Yes?
Is the reason that they wanted that area, though, not so much because they wanted Israel and Judah, but because they wanted to control the trade routes and the commerce going back to the... What was the main reason why they wanted the area?
Well, that is... you know, there's two answers. One is, if you're in power, you always want more power.
Yeah.
You give them an inch, you take a mile. But you're right about the trade routes. See, if you're going, what's down here? What's if you kept on going, what would you hit down there?
Egypt.
Yeah, no, Egypt's over here. What would you keep on going if you kept down there?
What? Arabia.
You'd hit the Red Sea.
Oh.
You'd hit a port.
You'd
hit a port to go out and trade through. And of course, what do you hit if you go over here? You hit the Mediterranean. You hit ports to be able to go out and trade and to commerce and be able to bring in income. So, and the major trade routes, see, here's Damascus. Major trade routes go like this and this, and there's a trade route along this side of the Jordan River. So, you know, that's a good point. There are good economic reasons why Assyria wanted more than they had already. It's if you've followed the wars in the struggle of Iraq, why did Iraq invade Kuwait in the first place? Because they wanted that port. Economic reasons, you know. Part of it may be Saddam is just an egomaniac too, but part of it is good, sound economic reasons. So Assyria came in and they took over what was the northern kingdom of Israel. If you look back at 2 Kings, Chapter 18, 2 Kings 18. It describes what happened. 2 Kings 18, verses 9 to 12. Do I volunteer to read that?
In the fourth year of King Hezekiah, which was the seventh year of Hoshea, son of Elah, king of Israel, Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up against Samaria, and he besieged it. And at the end of 3 years, he took it. In the sixth year of Hezekiah, which was the ninth year of Hoshea, a king of Israel, Samaria was taken. The king of Assyria carried the Israelites away to Assyria and put them in Halah, and on the harbor, the river of Gozan, and in the cities of the Medes, because they did not obey the voice of the Lord their God, but transgressed his covenant, even all that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded. They neither listened nor obeyed.
Okay. So they paid, Israel paid for their sin of following after gods beside Yahweh. And also, you know, this is talking about the entire Torah. The Torah is what? Five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch. And one of the sermons I like to give that comes out of my experience in Israel is if you read the Torah carefully, you know, the Torah talks a lot about how you treat people. And do you treat them right? And it's the same kind of thing Amos was talking about. So there was a lot going on that, according to the prophets, that Israel wasn't doing right. And so they paid the price. Assyria came in. Now notice, what did Assyria do when they took over that control of that area? What did they do according to what we just read?
Took them away
to Assyria. Exiled them, right? Exiled them. What Assyria's plan of operation was in the territories that they took over was that they would take out people from the land they conquered and put them and settle them someplace else, and bring in other peoples from territories they conquered to resettle in the area that they had just conquered. So new peoples were brought into that hill country there where Samaria was. Galilee, probably that area as well. New peoples were brought in, and the Jews that were living there were taken away. And they were one of the questions of history is, where did they end up? Where did they end up? Now, I used to believe that, and what I was taught, I suppose, way back, I don't remember what they told me in seminary, but is that that's the end of the 10 tribes of Israel, right? They're never heard from again, essentially, as the 10 tribes of Israel. And that's true. We don't hear of them identified in that way in any further documents that I know about. But the Jews that got settled off someplace else were still alive. And, you know, the question is, you know, there are probably some over in what is now Iraq. Some of them probably ended up down in Egypt, according to some scholars. That was the first diaspora. You know that term, the diaspora? That was the first exile of Jews from their homeland to someplace else. Now, if you remember later on, the prophet Jeremiah didn't want to go down to Egypt, right? And he was forced to go down to Egypt and he died. And one of the reasons he didn't want to go down to Egypt, according to some scholars, is because there were Jews down in Egypt, but they weren't good Jews. They weren't. They had come down from Israel and had settled down there, and they had built a temple down there, and they were practicing a form of the religion of following Yahweh, but they had allowed other elements to creep into it, so it wasn't very pure in Jeremiah's mind. He didn't want to go down and be part of those folks down there because they weren't doing their religion right. And so, but he was forced to go down there. So there were Jewish pockets outside of the land of Palestine after the capture of Israel by Assyria. But the Assyrians brought in other people to live there. Now, what did that result in later on? We'll jump history a little bit. Later on, there came to be a people in Jesus' day that were despised by the good Jews, Samaritans. And they were those persons who were descended in part from some of the peoples who had been brought in, who had intermarried with Jewish, not everybody had been taken off into exile. There were still Israelis, people who descended from Abraham in the northern kingdom, but they had intermarried with the people that were brought in and they weren't pure anymore. And then they developed worship on Mount Gerizim. The Samaritans worshiped there. You remember there's a good story in John chapter 4, is it, Bill, where Jesus and the woman at the well, Samaritan woman at the well. So that's the end of the northern kingdom. Now, what happens to the southern kingdom? Well, after Rehoboam, there is a much smaller territory
that is the southern kingdom, like a smaller territory than had been under, let's see, try this way. A smaller territory than had been under David and Solomon, certainly. There were some, according to the biblical tradition, there were some kings that were okay in the eyes of the prophets. Didn't do too bad in Judah. There were also some kings who did pretty bad. Along on the good side, there was Jehoshaphat. You've heard of Jehoshaphat. He reigned a long time. And he instituted some reforms, had a period of peace and stability. One of the reasons he had a period of peace and stability was that Jehoshaphat was willing to pay tribute and not make waves. And so that was a good thing in the eyes of the kingdom, at least in terms of its political stability. Later on, in 715 to 687, there was a guy by the name of Hezekiah. Have you heard of Hezekiah? Remember him? What was Hezekiah famous for? He's famous for a lot of things. He built a tunnel in Jerusalem that brought water out from, I don't remember the names of the places, but it brought water into the city near the Pool of Siloam in order to have water in the city of Jerusalem if they were being besieged from the outside. Because Hezekiah was afraid that the Assyrians were going to get him too. And in fact, the Assyrians, when they came in and captured Israel, they made trouble for Judah as well. They captured many of the cities around, but they didn't capture Jerusalem. There is that famous story of Sennacherib coming and besieging the walls of Jerusalem, and then what happens? You remember that? Remember your Bible history? Sennacherib, king of Assyria, is besieging Jerusalem. Sennacherib says, I got you captured like a bird in a cage. But then there is an angel strikes the Assyrians in the middle of the night, and a lot of them die. You know, whether it's cholera that went through the camp or whatever happened, we don't exactly know. But there is evidence in the Assyrian records as well that this in fact happened, and the Assyrians pulled back, and Sennacherib never did capture Jerusalem at that time. And so Hezekiah was saved, the land was staved off for a few more years from being captured. After Hezekiah, there's another famous king by the name of Josiah. Remember Josiah, who was the great reformer king? And Josiah, they found when they were cleaning up the temple, which had a period of not being paid attention to, apparently, very well, under Manasseh. Josiah instituted all the reforms, and when they opened up the temple and cleaned out all the closets, what did they find? A scroll, which was probably the book or a part of the book of Deuteronomy. Unfortunately, Josiah got involved in political intrigues. He was a good reformer king in the fact that he cleaned up the land and destroyed altars. There's a book I have that has a picture of an altar that Josiah destroyed that they found down in the southern area down here. Josiah got involved in the contest between who was going to control things between Egypt and over here in Assyria, Babylon. And right here in this plain of Esdraelon, where Megiddo is, Josiah foolishly was trying to keep the king of Egypt from going up here and controlling Syria. And he got involved in trying to stop him there, because remember, the route goes like this way to get up to Syria and to Damascus. And in this battle here, Josiah was wounded and died from his wounds. And because of that, the reforms and the and the Reformation that Sir Josiah instituted didn't last very long. Nineveh fell. Nineveh, which is the capital of Assyria, fell in 612 BCE. Who is the guy who came on the scene after Nineveh? The king of Babylon was named Nebuchadnezzar. Right. So Nebuchadnezzar came, and under Nebuchadnezzar, there were several different times where the Babylonians went into Judah and they took off into exile some of the inhabitants of Judah and tried to get the kings of Judah to pay attention to them and not try to ally themselves with Egypt anymore. But the last king in Israel that lived and held sway in Jerusalem, he wasn't bright enough to not kowtow to Babylon. He still tried to make an alliance with Egypt, that resulted in 587 with what happened? Do you know? 587, 80, the exile, the destruction of the temple of Jerusalem. So Solomon's temple, which was built in the 10th century, 950 or something, somewhere about that, was destroyed in 587, 86 by the Babylonians. Actually, before the temple was destroyed, they'd pretty much carted off into Babylon all the treasures of the temple anyway. In fact, as far back as Hezekiah had given away some of the gold and some of the treasures of the temple. Hezekiah even went to the temple doors and stripped the gold plate off of it to give to the Assyrians to keep them from attacking them. But that didn't work. Because the Assyrians said that isn't enough for us. You know, we want more. So most of the treasures were already gone, but by 587, Babylon came in and they said, listen, you guys were trying to play games, we're going to wipe it out once and for all. And they destroyed the city and they destroyed the temple. Let me read to you. This is an interesting book entitled Jerusalem. It's a history of the city of Jerusalem, but any history of the city of Jerusalem also includes a history of the land of Palestine. And so this author, I don't know how you pronounce it, but it's IDINOPULOS, who teaches at Miami University in Ohio, has an interesting summation of this period that I think is worth thinking about in terms of political sense, the political of the time. Had the original monarchy founded by David remained intact, had there been one Israelite army instead of two frequently locked in civil war, Israel as a nation might have been able to protect itself against the encroachments of the stronger powers. We could also say, following the insights of the prophets, that had Israel minded its own business and not meddled in international politics, the superior powers might not have been provoked into an invasion. For weight and treasure, neither northern Israel nor Judah were viewed as prizes worth the cost of invasion. Almost always, foreign invasions were provoked by pretentious, short-sighted, nationalistic ambitions on the parts of Israel's kings. Freedom from foreign rule is a precious thing, but even as a vassal state, Judah had the most precious freedom of religious worship, a freedom she was not always willing to grant to her pagan Canaanite neighbors. The key to Israel's survival lay in placating the foreign powers by tribute, treaty, and respect for their gods. Some of Israel's kings turned this key, others, out of religious obsession, threw it away. But if the Davidic monarchy and its successor state in Judah expired, the Davidic principle of national unity survived both the capture of Judah and the destruction of Jerusalem. The Davidic principle meant that the Judeans, the Jews, as we may now call them, might be exiled to Mesopotamia and other distant lands, but they would continue to recognize Eretz Israel, the land of Israel, as the true home of the nation. And they would continue to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of that nation, the site of the destroyed temple. The temple would be rebuilt on that day, the Lord's Day, when the nation would be reunited in the land and led once again by a Davidic king in Jerusalem. The prayerful hope in that coming day of redemption was expressed daily in countless ways by the thousands exiled to Mesopotamia. They taught the hope to a second generation, from whom arose a handful of intrepid souls who returned and colonized the ancestral land and its capital. Jerusalem would not be forgotten or abandoned. It is important to note that this sense of the land of Israel and Jerusalem as a city, as being our home, as being the place that is the focus of who we are as a people, is all the way back to the middle to about whatever this is, 500 BCE. So that is how many years ago? 2,500 years ago. The sense that the Jews have today of needing to return to the land, return to Jerusalem, that is our land, you know, that dates all the way back to this time when they were kicked out of town. So that's a pretty strong ancestral pull for the people that see themselves as Jewish today. And notice that it's not necessarily a pull tied to religion, tied to the faith in Yahweh. That the pull to come back to that land, to that city, has elements of it that are not related directly to the religion of their forefathers. It's a little bit broader than that. It's expressed. There's a psalm that you probably have heard before, Psalm 137. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down, and there we wept when we remembered Zion. On the willows, there we hung up our harps, for there our captors asked us for songs, and our tormentors asked for mirth, saying, "Sing us one of the songs of Zion." If you've heard Godspell, this song is in it. How could we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand wither. Let my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth. If I do not remember you, if I do not set Jerusalem above my highest joy. That's the sense of what they had in Jerusalem that they wanted to return to. Now, how long did they spend in exile in Babylon? Do you know? 70 years, right? That's not a very long time. That's a pretty short time. Babylon flourished briefly for a while, and then it went down. Who was Babylon taken over by? The Persians, right. The Persians, which is so we go from Iraq to Iran in modern terms. You see the contemporary application. These battles have been going on for millenniums, and sometimes I think when we think we're going to settle it all and it's going to be settled and peaceful once and for all, we kind of miss the lessons of history. Now, what happened to those who were in Babylon, who were exiled to Babylon? What did they do there? Do you know? They prospered, a lot of them. Okay? They were not necessarily oppressed in Babylon. One of the things apparently the Babylonians did is they took and they planted them on land that wasn't being used at the time, that there had been cities on once before, and then it had gotten defeated in one battle or another, and they took the Jews there and said, you know, you build a city again here. But a lot of the Jews prospered. And so when the time came, when Cyrus came along and issued his edict that the Jews could go back to the land, not all of them wanted to go. Not all of them wanted to go because they had developed good things. And 70 years, although it's a short time, it's enough for a generation to grow up that knew not the land of Palestine as their home. Okay? So while they still have feelings for that land that's been transferred to them for some of the second and third generations, they don't have knowledge of that land as their home. Babylon, where they were living, is their home. But there are other things that happened to them in exile. What developed in exile that helped them to go through their time as a people and still retain their identity as a people, even though they didn't have the temple?
Well, I think they established the Torah then, and so it was gathered together, so they became people of the book, not just the people of the place.
Okay. Okay. Of course, the Torah already existed before this, but there was bringing together of the scholars, the writing of the history of the people in a way that hadn't been done before.
Wisdom literature
came out of that period. There's some debate over whether or not synagogues came out of this period, at least in terms of how synagogues came to be identified later on, like in the time of Jesus. But the idea of the community of Jewish men, because synagogues are formed by 10 Jewish men, you know. That's just the way it is, women. I'm sorry. But the idea of gathering together to study the law and to study what was important to them as a people happen in this time of exile where they didn't have the temple anymore to sacrifice at. And so they had the people, they were the people of the book, the law, the writings, to hold them together as a people. So they were allowed by Cyrus to go back. And who are the names? Do you know the names of the people who are famous in taking them back to the land of Palestine?
Nehemiah and Ezra.
Nehemiah and Ezra, okay. Well, who was Nehemiah? Nehemiah, and let me before I get to Nehemiah and Ezra, let me mention that they happen a little bit later on in the scene than the first time that they were allowed to go back. The first king who led them back was Zerubbabel. And Zerubbabel was the last of the identifiable line of David. Okay, he was the grandson of the king that was taken off into exile in Babylon from Jerusalem. And Zerubbabel came back and he brought with him a bunch of folks and they began rebuilding the city of Jerusalem. Now, they didn't, the history with Zerubbabel and then Ezra and Nehemiah is sometimes clouded at points, but apparently they built some sort of a temple when they went back. Then a little bit later on, Ezra and Nehemiah come along. What's Nehemiah famous for building?
The wall.
The wall, okay. Nehemiah got them, those who came back. Nehemiah had been a cupbearer to the king in Persia, and he got the permission to go back and become governor of the land. And the land that they came back to and that he was governor of was not a large piece of land. Let's see. Let me show you again this map. See the blue area? That's Judah after the fall of Israel. Okay, time of Hezekiah, Josiah, etc. Now, this is how much territory Judah was in the time of 445, the time of the restoration, time of Nehemiah. So you can see that it was considerable shrinkage of how much territory they have. Now, one of the things that happened when Nehemiah came back and Ezra came back is that folks that were up north here said initially, "We will help you. We will help you rebuild." And their offer of helping to rebuild was spurned. Okay? Why was it spurned? Probably several reasons, but why was one of the reasons spurned? They were spurned. Yeah, their ancestry was of dubious distinction, right? We weren't sure you were of the pure line. Okay? Why else might they have not looked upon them with favor?
Well, their worship would be suspect too, I think.
Their worship was suspect, you know. We don't know if we want your worship to come down to our temple in Jerusalem. Okay? You guys have been doing things a little bit different. You've been singing different songs, you know, and that sort of thing. So we don't know if we want you to taint our worship down here. We
yeah, want your worship service at 10:30.
That's right. So they didn't allow. Which how did that? What kind of reaction do you think that produced? Well, it caused for several centuries there to be this clash between those folks living up here and those folks living down here, and they weren't always on good neighbor terms. And of course, again, remember then 400 years later, at the time of Jesus, the Samaritans up here and those folks who lived up here, they were looked upon as not to be mixed with, that people, when they went from Galilee down here to Jerusalem, they went along here. They didn't go through Samaria. They wouldn't even go through where those folks were. Of course, which was made Jesus radical. He went through Samaria. Okay, so Jeremiah rebuilds the walls. Ezra brings in the worship of Yahweh at the temple. One of the things that Ezra and Nehemiah both said is, you folks who are coming back and you folks that were rebuilding this the state of Israel with, the state of Judah, one of the things you cannot do is marry with anybody else around here. You know, no mixed marriages allowed. That was one of the things that as the years went on, they got them in trouble, was they married the wrong folks, you know, the people from the other side of the tracks that weren't pure. So there's the restoration of this land, and they're still under Persian. They're still under a part of the Persian Empire at this point, until several centuries later, Alexander the Great comes in. Now we're coming to the end here, so I'm not going to get that far. But Alexander the Great comes in, and he sweeps through what had been the Assyrian Empire and Syria down into Egypt, and Alexander and his generals captured all of that area, controlled all of that area. And so they were the next great kingdom to control the land of Palestine, were the Greeks. And after Alexander died, the territory that he conquered, part of it was divided up between a general who had control down here in Egypt and one who had control up here in Damascus and Syria area. And notice again who's in between. So which general was going to have the most power?